Bitcoin is actually the perfect asset to do this because it has been sort of engineered to appreciate in price in dollar terms forever. And so far that's been true. And if it continues to be true, then it should be the bedrock for all kinds of new ways of thinking about tools for financial freedom. Bitcoin has been described as the apex form of collateral and is a tool that presents new ways for thinking about wealth accumulation and wealth preservation and the offer for ordinary people to start employing the wealth building strategies that are typically only available to the ultra wealthy. This week we are joined by Hunter Albright from Salt Lending for a conversation about how Bitcoin is going to transform the way we think about wealth accumulation strategies and using Bitcoin as collateral to avoid tax events while accessing capital with the fastest growing asset ever. Stick around. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are joined by special guest Hunter Albright. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Maybe, so as we get started here, you've got a long journey through the Bitcoin world and a background like myself in traditional finance. Could you, maybe as a launch point, we just start off with a little bit of your background and how we got here on your Bitcoin journey?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I got started in my career really on in TradFi, working and participating in the running and management of credit card and loan portfolios. I have a background in systems engineering and AI and really got started doing risk modeling and a lot of marketing models. Sort of in the early days of adapting analytics towards portfolio management. And then around 2017, I started to learn more about Bitcoin and blockchain and got involved in teaching. I launched the first course at the University of Colorado in Boulder on sort of Bitcoin and blockchain, and also started to help do education with a nonprofit called C4, which runs the Certified Bitcoin Professional and other certifications, and really sort of jumped in with both feet at that point. Think that having been in TradFi for so long, understanding some of the strengths and the weaknesses of the payment and the banking system, was really excited about what the technology offered individuals as well as companies within sort of the Bitcoin and crypto space.
As we're thinking about, you know, your background, credit and debt, and Bitcoin presents itself as sort of a revolutionary way to think about collateralizing an asset, and love to maybe just have a 50,000 foot overview of sort of your view on how Bitcoin presents sort of a new kind of solution for people who are thinking about what wealth accumulation is.
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, some of the points that a lot of people talk about, I do believe the peer-to-peer aspect of it is really important and empowering to be able to sort of have a means of exchange globally, really without any other friction from, you know, that aspect. The other aspect is the portability. I think it's important for people to be able to take their wealth from one country to another country without any real barriers in terms of you're trying to move a lot of gold. It would obviously be heavy. If you're trying to move cash, you'd have hurdles at borders. And I think that portability is really empowering for a lot of populations, maybe not in first world countries, but people that really need to have that flexibility. I think it's important. And then the other element that I find myself talking a lot more about recently is the empowerment of being able to learn how to use an appreciating asset such as Bitcoin from a wealth building perspective. I really believe that this is a technology that is bringing the strategies and the tactics of the ultra wealthy to anybody. I think about my kids. I think about a lot of the students that I teach. And for them in the US, they are having a harder and harder time getting on the housing ladder. And that traditionally has been an asset where people have learned financial literacy. They have learned how to borrow against the equity in their house. And I think Bitcoin allows people to do that now with as little as $10,000, $20,000 worth of Bitcoin. You can start to understand how actually having debt and using leverage against that asset is not necessarily bad. And that's one of the things I think TradFi has done is really taught people that debt in many respects or leverage is bad because it's in many cases, it's sort of you're taking an advance against your income rather than borrowing against, you know, a collateralized asset where there is already value there. You're just figuring out a way to tap into it.
And maybe just to spell it out for the listener. So sort of this, the wealthy tend to never sell assets, right? They the value of those assets appreciates over time. They can use the equity inside those assets to accumulate more assets. And the other thing that this kind of does is avoid tax events, which is just a tax mitigation is something that the wealthy spend a lot of time and effort trying to understand and maximize. And the more of your own money you can keep, the better off you'll tend to be.
That's exactly right. I mean, the wealthy traditionally have taken advantage of borrowing against real estate, borrowing against stock portfolios that have allowed them to avoid, at least in the United States, capital gains taxes, which could be anywhere right from 20 to 35%. So it's a big number, even just being able to avoid that. Secondly, it also enables them to put their money to work in multiple ways. And so let me give a really clear example about this. So if I had a real estate portfolio that I had a bank that was allowing me to borrow against it. So let's say I had a real estate portfolio worth $2 million and they allowed me to take out cash against that. I might be able to take out $500,000 against that real estate portfolio and go buy other equities or go buy other dividend producing bonds or make other investments that allow me, one, not to pay tax on that cash that I'm borrowing against my real estate portfolio, but two, I'm essentially starting now to put my dollars to work in multiple ways. It's working in the piece of real estate that I own, as well as now it's starting to work in that second asset that I'm able to acquire. And that's what Bitcoin is allowing people to do today. So if I accumulate sort of $1 million worth of Bitcoin as an example, I can take out a loan against that Bitcoin and that cash, one, I'm avoiding capital gains or any taxable event on doing that. Two, I'm now able to put that cash to work and however I might see best for me at that point in time. So that might be buying a dividend producing equity that again gives me some cash that I can start to leverage, or it just might be funding my life and using that as an income stream that I'm either supplementing my income or maybe even funding my retirement.
Yeah, I mean, and Bitcoin, I guess the theory is potentially that Bitcoin is actually the perfect asset to do this because it has been sort of engineered to appreciate in price in dollar terms forever. And so far that's been true. And if it continues to be true, then it should be the bedrock for all kinds of new ways of thinking about tools for financial freedom, you know? And I think that we are at a really interesting crossroads right now. Did an episode a few weeks ago with Leon Vancum about how Bitcoin is sort of also designed to pull investors away from real estate. So for the investor that may be just looking for appreciating assets that they can use as collateral, Bitcoin is also going to present a compelling alternative for a lot of people who have traditionally used real estate. And it could actually result in real estate becoming more affordable, both in sort of Bitcoin terms, which it has done, but just in regular nominal terms. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's been a couple things that have been really attractive about investing in real estate historically. One is you have the pretty stable appreciation of real estate in a lot of different sort of locations and geographies. And so people have felt like that's been a very sound and safe investment from an appreciation perspective. The other element has been the cost of debt. And so that you're able to lock in sort of longer term sort of mortgages where if you lock it in at say 5%, it's 5% for the 30 years. So even as inflation's going up, your cost of debt in a mortgage actually effectively continues to go down. So that's been a point of leverage. And then sort of thirdly, you've been able to borrow against that equity as you start to build it up. So it's been a very effective tool. And I think from a Bitcoin perspective, that at least the predictable appreciation and one that outpaces the cost of borrowing is there. And that's been proven out over the sort of the last 10 plus years of Bitcoin, even if you think, like, I know Saylor is using, I think, 29% for his 10-year projection on the growth rate of Bitcoin, which many people feel is quite conservative based on the historical numbers. But even when you look at that, we are starting to see the cost of borrowing against Bitcoin come down. So even if you're paying, as an example, 10 to 12% interest rate on borrowing against your Bitcoin, you're still outpacing that cost with the growth of the asset. So you're able to get some additional flexibility and freedom in terms of being able to tap into the value, still have it be a net positive appreciation in terms of the asset as you go forward.
Do you think that you mentioned this, it is kind of a 10 to 12% rate there. Do you think that number is going to continue to come down, or what's behind that number?
So I do. I just got back from Bitcoin 2025 in Las Vegas, which was a fantastic show. And for me, I would say I had more conversations at the show this year than in past years from larger third-party sources of capital that are interested in lending to people that hold Bitcoin. And I think what we're going to see is two things that will be beneficial to the community. One is that will drive down the cost of borrowing, because a lot of the lenders in the space today have a high cost of funds themselves, just because there's not a lot of capital out there historically that have been willing to lend to the crypto markets. And so as we start to see the regulations change, and as we start to see the price go up and more traditional banks starting to participate, the cost of funds will continue to come down. The other element that will really be helpful is we'll see the duration of loans go out. So that also has been, for some of the lenders, they've really only been willing to loan on more a short-term basis, which has then caused lenders that are participating in the space directly to borrow to individuals on a retail perspective or to companies have really shorter terms. I think right now a lot of the terms are 1 year, maybe 2 year, but I anticipate probably within the next 12 months to 24 months, we'll see those terms go out to 3 years and even 5 years, so people can start to have a more predictable cost of funds for borrowing against their Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was in Vegas too, and I would say collateralization of Bitcoin, particularly as it relates to this rapidly growing treasury space, is maybe the what was kind of the talk of the event. Like, there was an announcement about Pakistan is intending to start a national strategic reserve. GameStop finally made their announcement about their treasury. There was a number of others. You know, we were in this time. It was only 5 years ago when Saylor announced the first MicroStrategy purchase. It really wasn't obvious why a company would want to own Bitcoin. And, you know, in a very short period of time, they have created some very interesting sort of financial products built on this very premise. And I think that as we get further along, there's this legislation in the US right now, SAB 121, which is going to enable retail banks to offer Bitcoin custody. And I think we're just entering into a period where the idea of owning Bitcoin, you know, as for the purpose of collateral, is about to get very normalized and mainstream.
I agree with you. I think the idea of treasury management or having Bitcoin in your treasury as a reserve asset is definitely being popularized, and people are becoming a lot more aware about it and why it might be of interest. So I think in the United States, there's over 15 different states that are looking and have passing bills to have Bitcoin on their reserves. You've got the Meta Planets and the MicroStrategy or the Strategy B that are really helping publicize it from a public company perspective. You've got countries that are now talking more publicly about their strategy about acquiring Bitcoin for the reserves. I think it opens up a whole set of questions about, well, how do you manage that reserve, and especially in public entities, whether it's a state or a country? But it will increase the awareness and the desire to have Bitcoin as either a personal, corporate, or sort of national slash state reserve asset and help people understand how they can tap into that value if they, in fact, are holding it within their reserves.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot. Bitcoin is really an apex tool for saving. You can buy as little or as much as you want. And it's a way to pull your money out of the system that intentionally devalues the currency or the thing that you're owning in that currency by design. And instead, just hold something that is really growing at a rate. We've never seen an asset appreciate in over a prolonged period the way Bitcoin has. And yeah, it makes me wonder, as we enter into this stage now where all of these sort of larger entities are trying to figure out how it actually works, what that will mean for Bitcoin. And I think that was... it's a fair question to leave from the Las Vegas conference over, like, how are all these different companies going to think about it? Are they going to hold? You know, what happens if the price starts to really, you know, if Bitcoin enters a downturn, how will these companies manage it? And what will it mean for all these different publicly traded companies? I think, you know, there was Microsoft famously brought Saylor in to talk to their board, gave him 3 minutes and decided that they had no reason to own Bitcoin. And the other one that happened this week was Facebook did the same. And it was an overwhelming rejection that they needed to own Bitcoin. Like, I think they just said they felt it was unnecessary. And it was like a 99% against it concept. And which is just wild. One of the points that I saw in a presentation that Saylor gave a few weeks back in Orlando was that only 4% of companies, publicly traded companies, outperform the S&P 500 index. And so essentially 96% of companies really should be buying Bitcoin because the money that they're reinvesting in their own business or issuing out in dividends or using for share buybacks is just a destruction of capital that is not beneficial to business. And so there's, you know, the idea is the longer that Bitcoin continues to outperform as an asset, the more compelling the argument is that, you know, more companies are going to have to at least consider this. And, you know, we really only talk about US-based companies for the most part, but I think there's a significant company in India now doing this. There's a story very recently over the last few months. I think they're called the Simple Internet Company in the UK that was like a $2 million sort of microcap stock and announced that they were going to start buying Bitcoin. They bought 8 million of Bitcoin and the company is now worth like 175 million pounds. And so, you know, there are millions of companies out there and only so many Bitcoin to go around. It feels like this could really be something that kicks off a different level of sort of supply shock.
No, I agree. And we've, some of the work that I've done historically and with, especially with the University of Colorado, has been advising small to medium sized businesses and rural businesses in the United States. And one of the things I'm excited about the opportunity for companies of that size, I think they're, you know, you're going to have the bigger companies that have some cash be able to buy Bitcoin and add it to their reserves, and they will benefit from that. But they're not necessarily the ones that really need it. I think that small and medium sized companies, if they can develop a discipline to be taking 5-10% of their revenues and investing it in Bitcoin and buying Bitcoin and putting in that in the reserves, it will create a whole set of businesses in all countries that are more resilient, more sustainable, because they can lend money back to themselves when they need it out of their treasury to overcome dips in the market, to overcome sort of drops in sales and reinvent themselves. Where today, a lot of those companies don't even have access to loans in a way that they need to overcome and bridge challenging times within their industry, within their company, within their market. So I'm really curious and excited by the potential of Bitcoin reserves and how it will help the small and medium-sized businesses as much as what it might mean for the publicly traded companies in any country. Because I think that's the other really interesting element, is this is not country specific. It's going to become global, where even real estate has traditionally been more geographically focused.
Yeah. You know, and I think that to your point about this for the small business, in places where the money has already failed or works a lot worse, I think it's been very normal and true for a long time that there is no real concept of reserves at all. So, you know, a small business in Argentina is probably just reinvesting any excess capital they have at the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the month to immediately back into, you know, productive pieces of the business. You know, I know in Costa Rica, like, they will just physically expand the building. If there's extra money, they will, you know, they just have to put it to use in places where the money is depreciating so fast that you actually just can't risk holding any of the currency. And I don't know that it's actually that different, you know, in North America or Europe. It's just that the time scale of it is different. So the urgency for deployment of capital or having a strategy around it is not, you know, maybe to the week or to the month, but it's the same underlying premise that forces these kinds of decisions.
I completely agree with you. I think that it's the velocity of degradation of whatever the fiat currency is in the country compared to the ability to sort of store the value and have appreciation in Bitcoin and in other harder assets, if you will, in terms of what people are choosing to convert their money into. I know I had done a lot of work in Turkey in the retail banking side at the time where the citizens of Turkey were converting their local currency into euros. And that was the transaction and the exchange that they were making to have their money hold its value longer, as well as being more portable and usable for broader markets and even in terms of buying goods. And I think we're seeing similar trends with Bitcoin, that people are able to now move it into something that is separate than from any other fiat currencies, something that has the built-in scarcity, right? Constrained amount of supply, which is an added protection. And then when we look at the trends in terms of who's buying it, you know, there is greater comfort that, you know, the level of participation, the level of investment in the network will really help preserve the value of the asset itself.
It makes me think about that, you know, there's so many levels for the game theory of this to play out. And, you know, you mentioned at the outset of the conversation, the peer-to-peer nature of it and its borderlessness. You know, Bitcoin is effectively like a Swiss bank account in your pocket. You know, for anyone who wants to have access to an international Swiss bank account, which is a very valuable thing in and of itself, and I think very underappreciated when it comes to people trying to understand Bitcoin and its value proposition. The third wealthiest person in Mexico is a person named Ricardo Salinas, who is a very public Bitcoin supporter and enthusiast, and he said a couple weeks back that he's debating moving 100% of his net worth into Bitcoin. And I think he's about 60% right now. So you mentioned these places like Turkey, and it makes me think, like, you know, there are so many people around the world today who are very wealthy in all kinds of countries, you know, second and third world countries, where they have exposure to these assets that are, you know, denominated in their own fiat currency, and also, you know, the capital constraint of not being able to get that money out of the country. So those people would be owning probably a lot of real estate, like you mentioned, art, gold, and all of those people will also have this kind of decision to make as Bitcoin sort of continues to do what it's doing.
Completely agree. I mean, the portability of it, to your point about having a Swiss bank account in your pocket, will go anywhere you want to go. And the portability of wealth has always been an issue, right? If you have gold, it's not very portable, especially if you have a lot amount of your assets or wealth in it. Real estate is not portable. And even if you look at the strategies of sort of the wealthy, they traditionally have started to divest and buy things in other countries, whether that's real estate in other countries, whether it's art that they're lending outside their borders, but things that they would still be able to access if they were to need to leave the country that they're currently living in. And it also helps mitigate any potential risk of anybody being a target of a group or a government or other sort of individuals, where you have the ability to have your assets in a form that can easily be moved to other people and or just moved with you.
Yeah, which I think will present all kinds of challenges for those who have traditionally really benefited from keeping using political borders to keep money trapped where it is, right? Like, that's actually been a really important part of the way the financial system has worked over the last kind of 100 years.
Yeah, when you think about the growth of, even if I go back and think about the growth of MasterCard and Visa and payment networks, all of those networks have really been powered by acceptance. So the ability to use your money worldwide. And that's what people were willing to pay for with those networks. And in many respects, I often describe Bitcoin is, if you believe that the value of, let's take Visa as an example, you believe in the value of Visa and their stock because of the overall network of being enabling people to make payments and enabling merchants to accept money globally and really helping sort of facilitate that. I think about Bitcoin as being a combination of both having that payment network globally, as well as then combining it with gold as the asset that is then used on that network. And so, you know, in response to the question about why does Bitcoin have value, I mean, I definitely believe it has real value because of the security and the tradability of the network itself, as well as then the asset that is on the network has the scarcity level that can act more of a store of value. And I think, at least my personal opinion, is that we'll continue to see Bitcoin probably act more as a store of value, and the transactions will be fewer and far between. People will use other stable coins. They'll use other digital assets to make payments. But I think a lot of that is still to be determined and to shake out.
The credit card thing, I think, is worth just talking a little bit about, because people might not understand, you know, especially you were talking about, you know, global acceptance of currency and ease of payments. And, you know, in third world countries, the additional surcharge of processing a credit card payment can really actually mean the difference between those businesses making a profit on a good or a service and losing money. And, you know, Bitcoin has a tremendous capacity or potential to be disruptive in this space. One, because of that, but also because of this problem of refunds and chargebacks, reversals. You know, Bitcoin is a final settlement payment, and you're also not waiting a week or a month for the money to arrive. Like, it's immediately there. Maybe just your thoughts on, you know, Bitcoin and, you know, our entire world today is built on credit and debt. So you couldn't almost even imagine how different a Bitcoin system might look.
Yeah. So the first point I'll tackle there is really like the reliance on debt and credit for consumption. And I think that's a big model. We mentioned earlier a little bit that in many respects, when you borrow, take out a loan or use a credit card and you sort of have revolving balances on a credit card, you're taking an advance on income, and people are buying. Traditionally, people have been buying more discretionary items with credit cards that are not necessarily appreciating assets that either drive more income for them or drive more wealth. And so it hasn't necessarily been a wealth building use of credit. I think with Bitcoin, that can start to change if people build underlying amounts, underlying reserves of Bitcoin that do appreciate. They can borrow against that, still use that to buy things they want. But I do believe they will have a differing view or a better understanding of debt, of leverage in a collateralized environment compared to an uncollateralized or unsecured environment. And then to your second point, the current payment structure, infrastructure around the world is driven on what is referred to as the four-party model. So you have the consumer that works with an issuing bank that is giving them a credit card. That issuing bank then settles with the merchant bank that is then supporting the merchant that is ultimately accepting the payment from the customer to the bank. And the issuing bank and the merchant bank charge fees. Now, they do some good work in terms of facilitating and providing protection. And from a merchant acquirer or merchant bank perspective, they help the merchant oftentimes with reward programs and with analytics around their transactions, as well as accepting the transactions. But Bitcoin definitely represents a technology that enables a customer to go interact directly with a merchant. And then both of those two parties now have more freedom and more power to choose other companies to help them for only the areas that they want help. And so it is allowing people to both have the responsibility, but also to have the decision-making power of where they want to invest any of that excess revenue, depending on their needs.
Yeah, and I think this, you know, this that goes back to one of the very first things he said again about this concept of peer-to-peer and how innovative it is that there would be no intermediate parties in between person, sender A and receiver B. And that is something that is, I think it's like there are so many subtleties of Bitcoin that are, you know, difficult to like appreciate how much of an improvement this represents on the way that we've engineered things and all of the different costs that are built into the way money is moved now.
I think that's right. And I don't expect a lot of the intermediaries to go away immediately. And I actually believe that a lot of intermediaries, as well as different custodial partners, have real value to add and will and help enable the adoption of Bitcoin. But I do think it's important for everybody to experiment with and try Bitcoin as a peer-to-peer technology so everybody understands the potential and also understands the technology and or skill gaps that as an individual you need to learn about and maybe improve if you ever want to be able to take over total control of the asset and be your own bank, right? I mean, I anticipate because of the awareness of Bitcoin, the increasing price of Bitcoin, that we will see people want to get into Bitcoin prior to them completely developing all the skills that are needed to properly manage it. And therefore, I think there will be in the near term an increasing need for third parties that are transparent, third parties that are operating with the, I would say, in line with the culture, the Bitcoin culture and intention, but still doing it as a third party service.
Maybe let's switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about Salt Lending and what you guys are doing there.
Yeah, it's Salt Lending. So Salt Lending has been around since 2016. It was sort of the first an original Bitcoin-backed lender in the space. And we're really, really focused on helping people tap into the value of their Bitcoin assets. And we, you know, being out in Las Vegas, reaffirm that it was great to, those shows are always so wonderful in terms of being able to speak directly to our customers that are already leveraging Salt, but also people that are curious about borrowing. It's great to see more lenders coming into the space. I think it's helping rebuild the credibility after the debacles of the winter of 2022. And it's important for people to be challenging lenders, one, in terms of, you know, what are the features and functions that allow them to have control of their assets, but also in terms of how they are protected. And that is something that, you know, we had a lot of conversations about in Vegas and are continuing to work on innovating around.
So for people who are listening and they want to learn more or are interested in thinking about using Bitcoin as collateral, like, well, where would you recommend people start? Or, you know, is there a consultative process that can help people get their heads wrapped around what to do next?
Yeah. So if you go to saltlending.com, there's some great resources there in terms of just what is a Bitcoin-backed loan, what is an over-collateralized loan, but would also encourage people to just do a little bit of research online about Bitcoin-backed loans and what are the features and functionality that you should be looking for in order to be able to take advantage of it. The interest rate is just one of the features that you should be looking at. You need to be looking at the custody model that a lender has, as well as some of the prepayment features and constraints on being able to withdraw your collateral. So as an example, at Salt Lending, if you took out, if you have one Bitcoin for, and let's say it's valued at $100,000 and you take out a loan for $50,000, if your Bitcoin were to go up to $200,000 a Bitcoin, we allow customers to take out that excess collateral down to the originating LTV of 50%, which then is helping putting you back in control of your collateral. And also you can pay off your loan early with no prepayment penalties. And those are some examples of features where it's really good to understand what the policy is of your lender so that you can be as much in control of your collateral or be as knowledgeable as possible about the terms prior to entering into an agreement. Because those will really help you manage your collateral the way you want to manage it and get the most value out of it based on your risk profile as well as your growth goals for the asset and the investment opportunities that you might have in front of you.
You know, and I think as well, it's a pathway to start thinking about Bitcoin as kind of a long-term hold. And, you know, this at a very, you know, high level, this idea that rich people don't sell their assets, you know, and like a lot of people who are getting into Bitcoin or maybe trying to flip it or, you know, buy low, sell high, and nothing wrong with that. But if you believe this thing is going to go up and it's going to continue to go up faster than other stuff, you'd be better off to keep as much as you can. And this is something I hope people can understand quickly as we continue on this ride.
I think that's right. It is. I mean, I definitely view Bitcoin as a real wealth building asset, one that people can and should be thinking about how to develop your own personal reserves, which will allow for you to be tax efficient in terms of leveraging your assets. I think it allows you to also be able to take advantage of different opportunities when you need to in terms of tapping into that value. At Salt, we see the common groups of use cases that we see. We see people borrowing against their Bitcoin to buy things that are important to them personally. It might be paying for a child's college tuition. It might be buying a car, putting a down payment on a house, but they're really important life events. We also see people borrowing against their Bitcoin for what I would call income bridging or income supplementing, where it's either supplementing their current income or actually just funding their retirement. And then the third category is a little bit what we've been talking about, investment opportunities, where you don't want to sell your Bitcoin, but you want to put your dollar, your value to work in multiple ways. So you borrow against it to buy real estate. You borrow against it to buy dividend producing bonds or dividend producing stocks so that you end up having a couple different appreciating assets stacked on top of each other, in addition to some yield generation, which you might be able to supplement your income with as well.
Very cool. Hunter, for our listeners who would maybe want to find more of you online, is there anywhere in particular we can point them to?
Yeah, I'm on sort of a lot of the standard platforms. You can find me at HT Albright, Alan X. I'm on LinkedIn, and I would love to connect and have conversations with people on both platforms. And if you are interested in Bitcoin-backed loans, check out saltlending.com. There's a lot of information to help people understand how to get started and the pros and cons of Bitcoin-backed loans.
Appreciate you coming on. This is a really important topic, and I thought it was a great conversation. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.